This is Rick Nielsen from Cheap Trick, and you're listening to J. Scott, the Hook Rock. Rick Nielsen, Cheap Trick, Rockin' Vodka, love it all.
Try to keep my spirits high, so I don't come down, even though I have to lie, to keep myself devout. It's hard to read between the lines, when everything starts to blur, and though I'm scared I won't make it out, I feel
welcome back. It's J. Scott. It's the Hook Rocks, the ultimate rock community podcast, sitting in a balmy -4 degrees here in Chicago. It's supposed to be a heat wave tomorrow, getting up to 28, which means we might be grilling. Who knows? But hopefully everyone is off to a great start to their new year. Hope everyone is staying positive and looking forward. And 2023 is going to be our year, meaning all of you and I. So hopefully collectively we can keep moving forward and be positive and talk some rock and roll. We are part of the Pantheon Podcast Network, great network of music related podcasts. Check out all the great music podcasts on pantheonpodcast.com. There's something for everybody there. And don't forget to follow the Hook Rocks wherever you podcast. We're on every podcast platform. Set your app to automatic download and write us a review if you're so inclined. We always appreciate that. We've had some great episodes to start the year off. We started off with our annual top 20 countdown of the best albums of 2022 and the top five EPs. So hopefully you enjoyed that. We also had Richie Kotzen on, the great guitar player, who's ready to release the third album from the Winery Dogs on February 3rd. So check out that great interview as well. We also reviewed the Buddy Guy and Leilani Kilgore concert at Buddy Guy's Blues Legends in Chicago. What a treat that was. I haven't seen Buddy in 25 plus years. Sounds amazing. Still got it. Still bends a string like nobody else. And Leilani Kilgore, who's based out of Nashville, is this emerging great blues guitar singer-songwriter. She just jams, and she is one to check out too. So please do that. And we also talked about Live Nation and Ticketmaster and the monopoly that it is. We talked about the U.S. Senate hearing that happened last week with Christy and Eagle. Great guest as well. We had Fastest Land Animal on the latest new music spotlight. Great kind of punk pop band out of New York and California. Their new album, East Coast, West Coast, In Between, is a great album for you to check out in the new year. And don't forget to check out some great episodes, too, before the new year. We had Dorothy Martin on, as well as Leilani Kilgore, and we also celebrated the fourth quarter of 2022 with a great list of albums as well. We've got a great show lined up for you today, and I say that before every guest because I love the guests that are on. I love the conversations that we have. A few months ago, we had a great producer out of Nashville named Paul Moak on the show, and it was great to get his insight and great to have that conversation. And we're talking with a songwriter and producer as well on this episode, and it was recommended by my great friend Tyler Baker from Goodbye June, who is always texting me, you should have this person on, have this person on. And he was adamant about this next guest, and I've been doing some research on him and kind of diving into his career and what he's been about. And I can't wait to talk to him. And that is singer, songwriter, and producer Scott Stevens. What's happening, man? How are you?
Hey, Jay. Thanks for having me on the show, man. I'm honored to be here. I'm a virgin to podcasts, so I'm breaking my cherry with you, brother.
Well, hopefully, you know, I'll be nice and easy for you. So
yeah, go slow.
Well, you know, it's great to have you on. Looking forward to getting to know you over the next hour, but we always start the same way every time we have a first-time guest. That's really what the show is all about, and why I started doing this is just like every rock song has a hook that sucks you in, that pulls you in. Every rock fan has a moment, whether it's a song, an album, a band, or performance that hooked you on rock and roll. What was it? What was your moment?
My moment that hooked me on rock and roll had to be, I think the first, I mean, how conscious of yourself are you when you're about 5 or 6 years old? But I do remember coming in from the backyard of my house in Denver, which is where I grew up. And I had to pass through the kitchen to get to my bedroom. It was just me and my mom. My father and her had divorced when I was like 2, I think. And I was probably 5 or 6, and I was going to my bedroom, and she stopped me. She said, "Wait, you have to listen to this next part." And I'll never forget it. And I turned and looked at her as she has her hands in the sink and she's washing dishes. And all of a sudden she goes, "She came in through the bathroom window," like that. And it just stopped me in my tracks, how passionate she was. And it registered with me for the first time, the Beatles and the electric sound of that moment in that song, which I think is a pivotal moment. If anybody knows the Beatles, that's just, they're building to that, and they're building, and then Paul's delivery in that moment, the release of it, it really affected me on a way that I can't possibly say what it was, but I know that I was hooked into rock from that moment on, and they became my all-time favorite. And the Beatles taught me how to write songs and how to chase the narrative and to ignore the narrative and get into lunacy sometimes. I don't think anybody's done it better than them. So that's where it started. That's it.
When you talk about that lunacy, it's had such an impact on people who love music, because they were really the first band to arrive on the scene, of the first rock band. And then they went to like this experimental mode where they didn't put any limits on their music, right? I mean, it was, you know, Sgt. Pepper, and even before that, Rubber Soul, right? And a lot of stuff that happened, and a lot of the differences with recording. We saw the Let It Be documentary. I don't think the Beatles are ever going to be appreciated with the amount of experimentation that they did and what it's meant to music in present day. And I think, you know, when you talk about that lunacy, it's like when you hear stuff on that album at that time in the 60s, that was kind of, you know, that was groundbreaking. That was something that was never heard before.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, to have one side of a record be snippets of songs that flow together in and out so well, and the lyrical content, the diverse storyline that is going on, is borderline absurd. But it's so colorfully done, so masterfully done, that you believe every bit of it. You don't really question it. I mean, you could go like, what is that about? What's Me, Mr. Mustard about, and Polythene Pam and all that stuff? But it just, somehow it rings a truth in you that says, I just take this at face value, and I guess you decide whether you like it or not. But it's, I mean, you could dissect it if you want, but I just feel like when it first hits you, you're just listening and you're just kind of going for the ride. And the Beatles, I think when you brought up the documentary, and I don't know if you remember, but George is, he's asking Paul, like, what's the lyric, Paul, for Something? And Paul just kind of goes, "Hey, I don't know, just keep mumbling stuff until, you know, you find the lyric." But that's kind of it, isn't it? It's like, you're just kind of, it's all, creation is messy. It doesn't have a form yet right away. You know what I mean? Like, creation could be messy, dude. It's messy. And it takes a while for it to take form. And that's what I'm trying to say. And I think that's what was evident in a lot of their music. You know, you could tell that they were mumbling through it and they just found words that they loved or that maybe just weren't 100% in everybody's face, and trying to be so obvious to leave a little bit of mystery in it for us. I don't know.
As you have moved forward with your career and moved forward within, you know, songwriting and production, you talk about that creative process being messy. How has what you do now, how have you gained appreciation for that messy process?
I think I've gained appreciation for it because I've learned to recognize when there is a kismet happening, when there's some kind of magic that is beyond the room, whether it's me that starts it or the artist, or if there's another co-writer in the room where something becomes, somehow it becomes truth and you just chase it. And when you're chasing it, I think I equate it to kind of like, a pure inspiration of either maybe an essay or a chapter in a book or some kind of painting, and you're just throwing shit at it, right? And you're just trying to get out the general kind of feeling of what it is that you're trying to say, and the sculpting and the refining of it comes in time. But so to speak, there's that splat of like pure inspiration. It's messy, and it takes whittling and crafting. But the one thing I've noticed with writing the songs and being a part of the artist that I am, even when I was, doing records, inspiration is quick and it's about 5 to 10%. And then the rest of it becomes sweat and refining it to make it into something that we can all either feel or relate to in one way or another.
When you're doing what you do, songwriting, producing, is it important for you to be in that messy process with the people that you're working with? Or is it completely up to you? Or is it completely only you that is feeling that?
No, it's definitely in the room. It happens. It's not just me. I might instigate it, or Dorothy might instigate it, or the, you know, I've worked with Lizzie, and I work with Ash and, you know, Lilith Czar and Brent Smith and all these people. And it just becomes, it's just something that I think we all kind of feel. I think everybody I've worked with kind of knows when something kind of magical is happening, and we just roll with it, you know, and go as far as we can before it kind of subsides a little bit. It comes in waves.
How do you decide what projects to work on?
You know, it's kind of like music. There's so many people out there that know so much more about what's going on in the current music, you know, climate right now, or movies or this or that. And I just kind of go, things find me. And when it finds me, I think it happens pretty quickly, whether if I'm asked if I want to work on this or whatever, I can decide it pretty quickly if it's something that I feel like I can contribute to, if I see myself in it. If I don't, I'm very matter of fact about that as well. I was working with Nothing More on their very first record. It was the very first time that they'd ever really done co-writes, and we were very, very lucky the very first time we did it, and we wrote This Is the Time, which is one of their biggest songs. And when that happened, Johnny came to me and said, I have this other song. It's called Jenny. And it's one of their, you know, staples to this day. And he just said, can you help me with this song? And I listened to it, and I was like, I don't hear anything wrong with this song, you know. And then we worked on like four or five more songs. And, you know, a few days later, he asked me again, let's look on this Jenny song. And I, like five times. And I just said, there's nothing wrong with it. So, you know, I'm not one of those producers or writers that feels like I have to get involved just because. And if it's right, it's right. And if I feel like I can contribute, I will. And if I can't, I'll be forward about that as well. And that's just kind of where it is. I don't know. It's not really a science or anything. Just
Is it important to know when to get out of the way?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, imagine some producers feel like they have to, maybe metal is the wrong word, or have their input. Maybe that's a better way to phrase it. You know, we always use that example anytime you deal with a lawyer, right? You hand a lawyer a document. Well, the lawyer's never going to come back and say, it looks great. You know, don't touch it. You know, because they'll feel like you just either wasted, you know, your money and you didn't get anything out of it. So they feel like they have to request a change or redline something. And I imagine some producers can be like that too. Whether that's right or wrong, that's, you know, not for me to make that judgment. But, you know, getting out of the way, I can understand when you feel something in a room and you feel the greatness of it, that it's just kind of perfect the way it is. Does that happen a lot, or is that something that is rare?
I think it's rare. But I'm always attuned to it. I'm open to it. I mean, let's go back and talk about the gentleman that connected you and I and Tyler Baker and Goodbye June. And I'll never forget. We worked on this song. It's called Charge Up the Power. And it was on the debut album. And that day, I felt like Landon was channeling some kind of gibberish that felt great, much like we're talking about with the Beatles. It didn't need to make a lot of sense. It felt great. And it was truthful to him. And I just got out of the way. Because I remember I was trying to make sense of a few lines, but as I listened to him do it, I became very aware that I needed to step back and I needed to let this flow happen and just kind of listen, take it at face value. How does it make me feel? Because if I'm not going to understand the lyric, then it's definitely got to give me some kind of a feeling. And there was a reckless abandonment with that song. There was an energy that was coming from him, and I didn't want to stop that because that excited me more than saying, well, what does it all mean? You know, I just, fuck that. It was like, let's just take the ride. This guy has a vision. I'm going with it. Same thing happened to me when I was working on a song called Blood Feather with Johnny Stevens, no relation, from Highly Suspect. And that first verse, he just had it. And I just got out of the way, you know, and just listened to him give it to me. And then, yeah, we wrote the chorus together and the pre-choruses and the bridge and all that. I had contributions there. But that beginning was just like, I didn't want to mess with that. I just had energy, you know. And that's what it's all about, dude. Music is a vibe, a feeling, and energy. The lyrics are secondary. I don't care who fucking knows it, says it, disagrees with it, whatever. That's the way it is. We feel things before we kind of understand them. And when the lyric is right, the music, it glides, you know, the lyric is what makes it effortless. You know what I mean? It's when the lyric is wrong, it's clumsy, but you need that melody first and you need that chord progression that is also catchy and that feeling. And that's how all good music starts. At least that's
so true, because when you think of listening to a song for the first time, it's always the melody that grabs you, right? It's
exactly
that brings the interest in, right? You can have the most beautiful lyrics, and if there's no melody and there's no hook, you're going to skip it, you know?
Yeah, it's next. It's got to go hand in hand. Yeah. It has to. So that's, you know what? I try to, in the capacity that I work in, and I try to push that as much as I can. And I've been very fortunate to work with some brilliant people, and they're as motivated and, you know, they want to get it as I do. So I'm fortunate that way.
I imagine being aware is very important for a producer, you know, just sure. Observing, understanding, and being aware of what's going on creatively. Because if you're not aware, you don't know when to get out of the way, right? You're so wrapped up in what you feel, you know, needs to be done on a song or an album that the awareness level is way down. So you always got to kind of have that radar going off and seeing magic when it's happening, or know when you notice it when it's going on.
Yeah. And I think I've, like I do this every day of my life, and I'm always on the lookout for it. It's very important to become the watcher as much as it is. Maybe I'm the cheerleader at times, you know, and the confidence booster, and saying, hey, you need to, can you sing the line like this? And would it look, it'd be better if we lifted the chorus with this chord. What do you think about that? You know, and those instincts happen all the time. And it's always kind of, it's always by committee, you know. I'm never go, this is it and you're wrong. You know, that doesn't happen in my world. I'm very diplomatic. If I feel like something isn't really working, I'll hammer it until at least it feels right. You know, if that's the artist coming up with it, or if that's me, we'll get to a place where we both like it. You know,
what's the story behind you finding your path with songwriting and producing?
Well, it all started when, like I said, with, you know, I was just a guitar player for many years. And that was kind of like my dream, was to be, I want to be the lead guitarist and I want to be that guy, you know, even though I could never play Eruption. And then I was in a band, a few bands that just, it seemed to take forever to get the songs done, and just the focus wasn't there. And so I mean, I can't really remember exactly how it happened, but I just had some kind of, you know, life epiphany of, I got to start writing songs. I got to figure out how to write songs to get to some point, you know. And I bought the Beatles complete score because it was my favorite band. And that year my grandmother had passed away, and she left me, I think, around like maybe $10K as in her will. And my rent at that time was $150 a month to live in this house. So I quit my job and I put that money to good use. And I lived in this tiny shoebox of a room, and I studied that score book, which fortunately for me was in tablature, because I couldn't read music. Although I did read music when I was a kid. I started off on trumpet when I was about 8 years old. And I did band and symphonic band. I was a band nerd geek until I was about 15. But when I switched to guitar, and Angus Young and Guitar Heroes and Randy Rhoads and Zakk Wylde and Steve Vai and all that stuff, all that music reading went right out the window, because to me that wasn't cool. You know, I don't, probably a stupid decision, but when you're that young, you know, what do you know? So, and I basically took this time and I studied this book, and I studied how the melodies went over chords, and the Beatles helped me get some kind of understanding of how song structure works and how chords and melody work. And, you know, I started to apply that within the songs of the band that nothing was getting done in. And all of a sudden, the songs that I was working on started to outnumber the songs of the other guys in the band. And we'd have producers down as we were trying to make demos, and everybody was picking my songs. And ultimately, that caused a rift in the band, which caused me to go at it alone and start writing and take the, you know, the singing position from the guitar position. And one, you know, I just practiced and practiced and practiced, because in the beginning I was terrible. And I just used to tape myself all the time and listen. And I spent a full year to a year and a half just in my bedroom learning, studying. And then we started to gig. And within about 8-9 months, we were getting chased by record companies. And that kind of going into that, you know, band world, and that the record deals happening and the A&R meetings and, you know, those kinds of things, that became all of a sudden, you know, a reality. And that helped really nurture the songwriting kind of a thing. And I did it for 12 or 13 years. The Exes got signed. We did 4 records, 3 of them being on major labels. And in that time, I met a lot of the people that I work with today as they were just getting started. And when I decided to leave the Exes, it basically, I called my wife. I was in a snowstorm in Michigan, and it was the end. We had peaked and we were going down, and I just couldn't see how we were going to get out of the hole financially and how it was going to turn around. And I used those connections of all those band people that I had met through the years and basically combined that with my years of being a recluse and studying to my love of songcraft and production. And the first guy to reach out to me was Tyler Connolly from Theory of a Dead Man. And we wrote a song together that got in the Transformers movie, Dark of the Moon. And that caught the attention of Pete Gambar, the head of A&R for Atlantic and Elektra. And he said, I have this girl and I want you to write a ballad for her, with her. Her name is Lizzie Hale. Have you ever heard of her? And I was like, yeah, I've heard of her. He's like, okay, I'm going to send her to you in LA. She showed up and I didn't have a ballad. And I said, but I have this song. It's called Miss the Misery. Would you like to maybe like work on that and finish that? And she and I spent 2 days on it. We finished it. And it became, I think, Hailstorm's biggest, I think it's still their biggest song right now. And so that whole shift of going from in the band, giving me all those years of like understanding what it's like to relate to an audience, a song that has to hit the back row, what the hook has to do, gave me some kind of like structure and backbone to when I decided to be a writer producer, that I could take that into the writing room and I could communicate it in a way that felt very pure of like, you know, to the rock and roll nature of songs. And it just, that's where it started. Those first few cuts is what kind of made it all happen. And then as you just do this, Jay, day in and day out, your writing craft just gets honed, just like anything. Tennis swings get better every day you do it, a golf swing or a balance or, you know, karate or judo or whatever it is, you know. So that was it. And it felt very fulfilling to be able to be with unbelievable artists that could do what I had in my head and also add to it and have them tell me what they want to do and help, and I can help them refine it. So it just became this totally, you know, symbiotic relationship where we're just like, we're helping each other to achieve the same goal. And it was very rewarding. And the fact that I didn't have to go out and promote it, tour and get sick and lose my voice and, you know, being in 100,000 different uncomfortable situations on a dirty German infested tour bus, you know, so it, but I do miss those things sometimes. But it was, that was the, that's how it all transitioned from the bedroom to where I am today. And I don't think I would trade it for anything. It's been a pretty magical ride, and it's continuing, you know. I'm very blessed. I have a lot of records in the works right now, and I've had a great last 3 or 4 years.
When you first started this process with Lizzie, this first song that you wrote with her, as you moved forward from that, was there anything ever pulling you back to wanting to be your own artist and make your own music, you know, or did you want to focus solely on writing music because it was so rewarding with that experience?
Yeah, at that time, there was no going back to doing what I had done before. This was a new challenge, just because I had been a part of a couple songs that were working and doing things. I didn't have anything really figured out. You know what, man? I still don't. Every day is what's going to happen. You know, can I get this? I still get nervous about, you know, trying to help make the session move and that there's some kind of result at the end. But at that time, no, I feel like I was so in it. I was so encouraged by it. I was so scared by it that it was worth doing. I never looked back, you know. And I will say this, I mean, watching my band kind of go through those real painful last few years was something I never talked about, even with the band guys. I don't even think I talked about it with my wife too much, where how hard that was to watch that dream kind of die and see that it just wasn't working. And I realized that it wasn't a pity party, and I couldn't talk to anybody about it, but I had to cope, and I had to deal with it myself and go through that pain and the reinvention of what I'm going to do now, you know, and because that's all I wanted to do, you know. So when those first things happened, I felt like that might have been some kind of divine, you know, universe looking out for me, or some kind of manifestation of it's going to be okay, you know, like somehow I got lucky to get two really good, great artists right off the bat that helped make it all seem worthwhile and continuing. So I hope that answers that.
Were there any mentors for you that helped you through that adjustment and helped you through wondering if you're going down the right career path? Were there people that you look to for always encouragement and support?
Yeah, there were. There was a guy that I'm in business with now. We can get into that in a little bit, but Marty Fredrickson was a mentor to me. And I had been in contact with the guy that had taken me on my very first tour. And he was kind of educating me a little bit about songwriting sessions. And that was Zach Malloy from the Nixons. And I was learning as I went, you know. There were, at any given moment, there was co-writes with another writer in the room, and I would learn from them, you know, too. It was always a learning environment. It was always, I know nothing, but I know that I can contribute somewhere, you know, in the song, and I hope I'm given the opportunity to do so. And sometimes it didn't really work out, but, you know, I got my break, I think, with Marty. He gave me my first real cut, before Tyler. Actually, that's right, I'm remembering it now, so we have to go back. But I think my first cut was with David Cook from American Idol. And it was a co-write that Marty had set up. And because I think he was producing some of that record or something like that. And yeah, I was just a co-writer on that, and that kind of started it. And then I believe the Tyler thing happened right after that. So yeah. So it was always there was always something to learn. There was mentors, there was people around, the writers. Like, Tyler's a great writer in his own right, you know. Lizzie has great ideas, you know. Like, these people are giving you fuel for you to do what you do too, you know.
You mentioned, you know, kind of the coping, you know, when you're writing, when you're creating. And we look to the song you just released with the Exes, Spirits High, and about that was more or less, you know, about an emotional journey coping through the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And you know, trying to figure life out as we all were during that, and trying not to get too low, and trying not to, you know, think the world's going to end, you know, with this thing going on. You know, when you sat down to write this song, you know, how did you filter out all those emotions that you were going through?
I mean, I don't even know if I don't know what I filtered out. I know that that, that to me feels like, a page. Like, I think I've said this a couple times. I feel like this, that song is a page out of a diary. That, that, that was a private moment for me. That was something that was meant for me as a coping mechanism. Something, a feel good place, since the X's weren't making records anymore. It had been 16 years since our last record. And I used it as a, it's kind of like a warm blanket, or maybe it's a, an old movie or something that, that gives you some kind of nostalgic kind of comfort or peace. And this song, when it, when I first strummed the first three or four chords of it, it really reminded me of a song called Ugly that we had that was one of our biggest hits. And I remember kind of going, well, that's, that really feels like circa 05, 04 XEs, you know? And I didn't really work on it very much. I kind of just kept it to myself, and it seemed like every once in a while it would come out. And that doesn't usually happen for me. I don't know why that song in particular would find its way from the, you know, the vault or the box or, you know, whatever it is. And I think, you know, I started to make little recordings of it on my phone as it was mumbling through it. You know, going back to the Beatles, trying to figure out what does this thing want to say? And every time I would forget about it and I would stumble across the recording, it sounded refreshing to me in some way. It felt like some kind of hope beacon. And I started to work on it a little bit more and a little bit more and line by line. And I really was like, well, what have I, you know, there's no committee here telling me what to do. There's no label. There's no other opinion. There's not even a band. You know, there's nothing but me and this guitar and this feeling. And I just tried to follow it as truthfully as I could of how I felt in that moment and how I didn't want to be with people and I didn't know how to be with people and how I was scared of just what is going to happen to not only, you know, not to, to me, my wife, my fam, my mom, you know, like everybody, like what, my brother, my sister, everybody, like what are we, how, what is this? You know, nobody's been prepared for this kind of a thing. And line by line, it started to form, and it became something, I think, around 2021, the back half of 2021. And then, you know, I remembered that, I don't know what triggered it, but that it would be the 20th anniversary of Inertia, which was our first major label album. And I thought, how cool would it be to, like, you know, like release a new song for all the fans that have been listening to, you know, to us throughout the years. And it was only like, I think the year or two before that I found out that we even had a Spotify page because we didn't set it up. Somebody did. And that the numbers were actually decent. And I was like, how's that possible? You know? And within the course of that year, last year, from like February 2022 to now, somehow the X's playlist tripled and we were getting from like 140 of listeners to 460,000 every month, wow. 2.2 million streams a month. It was like, what's happening, you know? And I think that that when that Wrapped came out and the decision to say, I'm going to release something for the fans and I'm going to try to honor the past. And this song feels nostalgic as fuck. It really feels like you're just, you step into a time machine, but somehow it feels relevant because I feel like we're all going through this fallout of not only COVID, but the first 3 years before where our countries, whether what side you're on, Republican or Democrat, were divided. There's a lot of pain going on. And so somehow we're starting to kind of, I think, get through that a little bit. We're starting to shed it a little bit this year. but we're all still feeling this like underpinning of sadness somehow. It's not an everyday thing, but it's definitely there. And everybody I know feels it. And somehow this lyric is embodying that for me. And I'm finding that it's doing that for a lot of people. And so, you know, we released it on January 27th. I set it up a week, literally 7 days before, with some like teaser photographs of an image. My wife took the picture, and I had a friend of mine manipulate the art so that, and he put the disintegration of me, going into the sky, which I thought was really, perfect for the whole spirit's high kind of a thing. And it was a cold, shitty kind of day and no leaves on the, trees. And it just, she caught a moment, and it just became something. When I saw the photograph, I think she probably snapped like 50, 60 pictures. But when I saw that picture, I was like, that's it. That sounds like this song. And I had the artwork done and we released it. And I never thought I would release another XC song ever, but somehow this is connecting and people are feeling it. And that makes me truly, truly happy. And I think that I don't think I knew how much I needed it. And I think because maybe I work with so many bands and my voice is there with theirs. And this one is fully my voice. And that was hard to do. That wasn't easy. That was uncomfortable for a minute. And, I just took the leap of faith and courage and we put it out and we'll see what happens with it. But it feels great to have it out there. And I know a lot of people are happy that we, that I did it. And we'll see what happens now. I don't know.
you mentioned that song and how it kept coming back, right? And I think it was just from an observation standpoint, when you're writing something about something that's happening and it's so different and it's so emotional that voice that song allows you to have for that moment needs to get out, right? It needs to speak.
Yeah.
Because we were all going through it, like you said, and everyone's experience with it is different, but it's also the same in some ways. But, having something that is connecting with you in that moment, because you're connecting with the moment, it needs that voice. It needs to be heard. And I think that's probably why it kept reoccurring for you. It wouldn't go away.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, man. And it was a pest. And but a loving pest, I think. And it's good to get pushed out of your comfort zone. And
absolutely,
like I said, it's really good to get scared, because when you get scared, sometimes the best things come out of you and you don't even know what you're capable of, and then all of a sudden there it is. And there's you, you're it's like an essence of you. Right. And it stares back at you. And so I feel that no matter what happens from here, that was supposed to happen, even though I never thought it would. And I don't know where it's going to, what's going to happen from it now. I don't know where it's going to take me, but I certainly loved and hated the process all at the same time. Whoa, what was that? I thought I heard something, but yeah, man, it was, now that I look back, it's like what Joe Walsh says in the Eagles documentary. Your life is like full of these moments that are like smashing into one another and there's chaos. And then you kind of get through moments and you look back and it's like a finely crafted novel. And I think about all the turbulence that's happened between me deciding that this should come out between August and now. It's been a hell of a ride. I mean, there has been tragedy and there has been unbelievably elated moments. There have been friends I've been hearing from that I haven't heard from in 20 years. And so it's all this very, this unbelievable reunion of, nostalgia, you know, and that's a powerful thing, man. I mean, I'm not saying nobody needs to live in the past, but sometimes when it's like this, it's healing, you know, and it lets you, everybody know that you're still around and that we're still fighting. We're doing whatever we're doing. So, you know, and it was tough because our original guitar player, he passed away at the end of the month. I mean, at the beginning of the month here. And it was a shock because I knew this was coming and I wanted this to share this with the three original members so much that I'm still in a conundrum of like why this has happened. Why did he have to, you know, why did he go right at the time when.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shouted Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
I had decided that like it's time to celebrate the past because I think I had been asked at the 10-year anniversary and I flat just turned it down because I just was too involved in what I was doing with other bands and producing. And I just didn't want to do it, but this one was different. And, you know what? I don't know. It's going to reveal itself or it isn't. And I just know that it's made the other two members very happy. It's made me happy. It's made my family and the fans that have connected with it happy. And I know he would want it. So, I guess I'll leave that at that.
Yeah, you know, there's that beauty that comes from tragedy. There is. And sometimes it takes a while for it to reveal itself. But I've always believed out of something bad, something good happens, you know? And if whatever that is for you, whatever that is for the other members of the band, you know, and unfortunately, you know, the passing of a friend, the passing of a bandmate, you know, there's never a right time for it. But to kind of have that align with this song that is now taking on a life of its own, I think there's a beauty in that too, you know, as you mourn that loss.
I hope so. You know, I do feel his spirit is in there as he was part of the road, you know, that helped build it. I mean, he was such an integral part to the XCs. You know, he brought in the song My Goddess. It showed it to me in a hotel room when we were on tour and said, I got this idea, and we worked on it. And that changed the course of my life. And without David, that, you know, that road just wouldn't exist. And, you know, that road brought me to every artist I've worked with, because the band brought me there. You know, I learned how to do what I do because of those touring years and being in that band, with him and with Freddie and with Dennis, later on with Chris Skane and Isaac Carpenter and Hoss Wright, you know, who have all gone on and playing in other bands and done really great things. That journey, is the novel, you know, that we were just talking about, you know, a second ago with Joe Walsh. I mean, it's so finely written right now, isn't it? It's clear. It's crazy, man. It's crazy.
You talked about being scared during the creative process or going through that creative journey. What's the moment where you felt helpless, you felt scared the most, and out came a song, out came an album that was more than you expected?
That's hard to answer, man. That's I think I tried to sing this song about 5 or 6 times over the course of like 2.5 years. And I think maybe the first time I did it, it might have yielded a few like lines that I kept or whatever. But I believe that when I finally hatched the chorus lyric and I sang it, is not like a record, as a keeper thing. And I heard it back. I got really taken aback by, for one, it sounded right. I had the right intent coming out of me, and it matched the music, and the lyrics matched the feeling. And as a songwriter, that's kind of what you're always looking for. You're looking for that melody and then that feeling and then that lyric that kind of makes it all glide. And it just felt truthful. And I got really nervous about finishing it and owning up to the power that it had just showed me of what it could potentially be. So I, even though I'm the one writing this and singing it, I feel like I'm the student and it's just larger than me, and I'm just trying to hang on. Yeah, that's the only way I can put it. It scared the shit out of me. Like that now I have to finish it because I really love the chorus and I love what it's saying. I don't know if anybody else is going to love it, but I love it. And it's like a therapy session. It's getting me through this time right now. And it feels like this time right now, you know, that I was going through then. And that's when I kind of was like, okay, now I have to shit or get off the pot, you know, and I gotta follow through here. And the follow through, as you know, in life, man, anybody knows that's hard, man. That's seeing it through. I mean, we can all have a brainstorm and a this, but like I said, it's ugly, right? You gotta find it and refine it, and you gotta keep going at it. Otherwise it's nothing. So that was it. Probably like the fourth time of attacking that vocal.
And what song was that?
Oh, well, that's Spirits High. That's the new one.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Are you talking about in the past too? Are you talking about past song?
Yeah.
I'll never forget. We were doing this song called Creeper Kamikaze. It's on the Inertia record. And that was a song that David brought in as well. And we had strings cut on, we were at Capitol, where, you know, Sinatra recorded and this and that. And we had a 16-piece string orchestra on that song. And it was, for me, watching a, you know, the LA Philharmonic, 16 of them sitting there playing your song with such beauty and control. And your producer is the one that's written the string arrangement, and he's out there and hasn't slept all night because he was up doing the string arrangement the night before. And they're doing this thing. It just became so overwhelming. And I was so freaked out about, like, how do I sing a song that's as great as these people, you know, like that are doing this? Sure. I mean, there's no way I can sound as high art as this is, you know? And I think it was a month later when we finally started to track the vocals, and I'd been dreading this day, and I got in the booth reluctantly, and I started to do the song, and there was, you know, these high notes, and there's these long healthy, and I just couldn't do it. Take after take after take. And I started losing my confidence, take after take, losing more confidence. And now I can't do it. And I remember saying, I need a moment, put the headphones down. And I walked out the studio door, and I don't know how to explain it, Jay. I just asked for some kind of help, some kind of guidance. I need help. You know, it was full vulnerability, full humility, whatever it is. I went back in the booth, and I got it within like four takes, and it was done. And there it was. I'll never forget that day, because it was like something helped me get that confidence. Something pushed me right when I needed it the most, because that shit wasn't going to happen if that moment right there hadn't happened. It just, wow. It may be the next day or maybe another day, but not that day, you know, but there you go. It did. So
is that emotion whenever you're creating reserved just for you, or do you have the same emotion when you're collaborating with somebody as well?
Oh, I have it when I'm creating with other people all the time. Absolutely. I mean, if there's five people in the room, six people in the room, and we're all hitting on something, it's the same. You know, when it's got that feeling, it's real magic. Or, you know, it may be a song that never really ever does anything, but that's not the point. Whatever's happening in that moment becomes larger than the room. Everybody feels it, and everybody's agreeing with it, and everybody's putting their heart into it. And that, when you are truly open, that's when great things happen. That's when songs are probably book ideas or film ideas or things that are creative. Thinking of doing a podcast, there's a moment of clarity where it all makes sense. And that's it, man. So yeah, it happens all the time.
You know, when you're writing with different artists, whether it's Lizzie Hale, whether it's Dorothy, whether it's the guys in Goodbye June, how do you navigate with each different personality, or how do you, are there different ways to get creative with each of those artists, or is it something that, you know, is pretty much uniformed with each session, right? I mean, each session kind of has that own type of vibe, but you kind of try to gather, quote unquote, gather the troops in to write a song. Or how does that whole process happen, and how different is it with each artist?
It's very different with each artist. The one thing that I do that is a constant is I always do my homework. I look at back songs. I may look at their Instagram. I may look at their Twitter feed just to see what they're maybe talking about, to just to try to get inside their head. You know, they may be going through something, or they may say something cool. You know, like there was a song called Amen that I wrote with Lizzie and Joe, and Lizzie had done this post like that said, My love, my church, my rock and roll, my Gibson guitars, or something like that. And it was all hashtags. And that just struck me, and I wrote it down. And when she came in to the studio, which was like maybe 2 weeks later, I said, you remember that post? My love, my church, my rock and roll, my this and that. She said, yeah. And I said, you wrote a song. You might not have known it, but I think I got something here. And then it became the chorus of Amen was born out of that. And then we finished the rest of it. But I think it comes from studying. Like when I worked with Goodbye June, I listened to Paul Moak's first songs, which he's brilliant, and tried to get inside. And I was scared as hell to work with that band because they just seemed alternatively cool and not what I normally do, you know? And I was like, how do I fit in, you know? And, you know, again, my wife, she's such a voice of reason, and she's just like, you just got to get in there with him. You just got to go with it. And look, if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. And she was right. And so I did my homework, but, you know, I had to wait for them to get in the room. I had a little start on a piano, and our first song that never even made a record, it didn't even make a record, was something that I showed them, but it bonded us together. And they saw that I kind of understood where they were coming from. And I think that's the secret, is that you got to understand what the artist is into. You got to add your own flavor to that of what you feel, like how you see them. How do you perceive them? Because I am the listener. I am the audience, because I'm not them, right? So I have to say, okay, I'm here to help you with your vision, but I'm the fan that's here. This is what I want to hear from you. I want to hear Lizzie hit that scream, and I want to hear Dorothy go, and I want to hear, you know, Landon wail like Bon Scott for a moment, you know, and I want to hear Tyler rip a guitar like this. Dude, go like that. Give it to me simple, you know? And it all comes from those kinds of, you know, you study a little bit. And, you know, look, man, I've been in music a really long time. So I do have a, you know, a back knowledge of a lot of different stuff. And I listen to them, and I can say, these guys remind me of Skinner a little bit, and they remind me a little bit of this, and a little bit of Kings of Leon in there, and there's a little bit of that. And then you just do the best you can. You know, you hope that it lines up and everybody's trying for the same thing.
Everybody's pointing in the same direction.
Yeah. You can't have it. But, hey, I'm going to go east. I'm going west. I'm going south. You know, so hopefully you get on the same page and everybody goes true north.
Yeah. You do work with a lot of modern rock artists. You know, we mentioned, you know, the names we've already, you know, talked about, you know, and you come from that school of record label, record company, record deal. And, you know, the landscape of music is so different now. Yeah. How have you adapted, or what was the easiest way for you to adapt to this new world of music?
Probably not to be an artist in it, you know, probably to just be lucky enough to, at the turn, the curvature of it all, to be lucky to be on the board and to be, you know, on the Pro Tools rig. And, I had to adapt to that. Look, I used to run. I was a runner in studios. That's where I got my record deal. I was around the rooms. I was a part of so many big records, and maybe that's a conversation for another time, as either a studio manager or, you know, a night runner or a day runner. But I never wanted to get in the room and learn the console because I wanted to be in a band and write songs and go tour. So I avoided it like the plague. That's not for me. And I guess there's some like old saying, one often meets his destiny on the road that he chooses to avoid it, you know? So it's, I think that's like from Kung Fu Panda or something, you know, but there's some wise words in that funny movie, but like that's what happened to me. And I had to learn to be in the box. I had to learn technology. I had to learn, you know, something that I just didn't even care. Computers. I didn't care about any of it. And then not only that, learning about compression and EQ and just how things go together, you know, but I had some good teachers in the beginning, Marty Fredericks and James Michaels, who sings for 6AM, and, you know, other people that kind of showed me the way. Mitch Allen, who was an SR-71, you know, that just were kind, gave me some lessons. And then a lot of it was just me elbow grease, sleeves rolled up, go. Thought, time, you know, patience to learn it. So it was not easy to adapt to a new digital music world, but it was just through time, man, and patience and reading and getting that knowledge wherever I could. I had to be hungry for it, and I was.
You've done a lot with Marty over the years.
I have. Yeah, we had a hiatus for a while, though. I think it was about 8 years. We started off together, kind of just, he didn't really work with me in that, in like a, let's write songs for, you know, people, dude. It wasn't until that David Cook moment, but he was working with some bands and he had me in writing with those bands to try to, you know, diversify the songs or whatever. And he was the one that, you know, he cracked the whip on me with, the Pro Tools stuff. Like, 'cause I was so slow. He's just like, you're never going to get anywhere in any studio in these sessions if you don't learn how to go quick. People, you gotta make it work fast. And those words scared me. And, so I began the work. And then for whatever reason, I think he got busy and I got busy on some other things. And I had a few breaks, you know, that Hailstorm stuff and whatnot. And the Theory of a Dead Man and, like, I think Skillet and a few things that were really clicking and working. And we just kind of got torn apart for a little while. He went and did his thing, I did mine, and then I don't remember what brought us back together. I think it was Daughtry. Chris Daughtry called me, and I'd worked with him on the Baptized record, and Marty had worked with him on the record before that, wrote Crawling Back to You, which was a big radio hit, and Chris said, hey, you want to get together and write? I was thinking about having you and Marty together to do it. And we wrote a song called Backbone. And that was what brought Marty and I back together. And and then it just became, you know, a project here, a project there. And then we started working with Aaron Jones. We wrote Mercy with Aaron and we produced great that song. Yeah, went number one, 5 weeks. That was a great day because that was the first co-write, bro, that I had done from the pandemic. First one, like after being in my house for 2 years, was Aaron, and we wrote Mercy with masks and everything. And it was, I think, the first number one that Marty and I shared together. And then from there, you know, some things we work on by ourselves and some things we work together. We're going to do the new Daughtry record together. You know, we just did the new Separate Ways cover with Lizzie and Chris.
Yeah.
Together. And we're doing the new Aaron Jones record right now. I co-produced the last Hailstorm record with Nick Reskulinix, and that was one where they were already with him, you know, so Marty wasn't really a part of that one, but he's done like Buck Cherry, and I really wasn't a part of that one. So it just, like, it depends on the project, and we kind of go in and out, and we work really well together. We have like 4 studios between the two of us to be able to work remotely or whatever we need to get done. It works great.
That Separate Ways cover was interesting because it's very hard to cover a very iconic song from a band. I mean, that song, other than Don't Stop Believing, and you could probably say Open Arms in that too as well. I mean, that was, you know, early 80s. That was kind of like the defining moment for that band, you know.
Yeah,
the video is so cheesy.
Yeah.
The song is so awesome. And then you hear, I always get nervous whenever I see a big song like that get covered, because it's like, well, this is tough. This is a tall mountain to climb, you know, and it worked, you know, and it's always, I always appreciate when the artists try to do something different. It's not a carbon copy of the original.
Exactly.
I make a carbon copy of the original because you're never, you know, that's why I think when people really compare, when you're trying to do the same thing, when you're trying to do something different, it kind of makes it your own song. And, I really enjoyed that. I surprisingly enjoyed that because I, you know, one of my first moments of growing up and getting into music real brief, I've mentioned this before on the podcast. My grandfather was a lounge piano player back in the days of the speakeasies. So he used to, you know, play for all the mobsters in Chicago.
Wow.
And he tells this story that one of these mobsters broke up with his girlfriend and he held a gun in my grandfather's head for 4 hours and made him play the same song over and over again because it was the song he had with the girl that just broke up with him. So these crazy stories. And he used to have this baby grand in the basement of his house, and I would stay over there once a month, and I'd wake up on a Saturday and Sunday to this booming piano. I mean, he played the piano like thunder, like it was, you know, heavy, you know?
Yeah, heavy mitts, man.
Yeah, and my brother, who that's where I got all my rock and roll from, borrowed Journey Escape from a friend of his. And this, I was, you know, you mentioned like 5 or 6 years old. I was probably six.
Yeah,
when
yeah.
I first heard this, and he put the album on my parents' phonograph, and he put on, you know, the first track on Escape is "Don't Stop Believin'."
Mm-hmm.
I immediately heard the piano, and I'm like, "Oh, that's what Grandpa plays." And then I heard the guitar and the voice, and then it was over for me. I'm like, "I'm right. This rock and roll stuff is awesome."
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But you know, when you know, Journey was such a big moment for me in my life. You know, whether it was the Escape album or the Frontiers album. You know, seeing that Separate Ways cover, I was like, oh, someone's covering Separate Ways, but it was kicking ass. It was awesome.
Thank you, man. Yeah. You know what? It had, that's a thing. It had a feeling. You can't control those things. You know, we talked about it a lot. Lizzie loved that song. It was her go-to karaoke. It was Chris's idea to do that song. He called me and said, you work with Lizzie all the time. Could you call her and see if she wanted to do this? And I was like, man, I'm not going to do that. You call her. You know, and he did, and she said yes. Thank God. And I guess those two talked about it a little bit, and then I think he went on tour, and he sent me a little clip of what he thought maybe the direction could be with Elvio, his piano player. And it was, you know, it gave me enough to go, okay, here's what we should, yeah, this is what we should do. Cause I think Elvio had, he didn't have a guitar on the road and he's the piano player, but he programmed on the piano, and that was enough to kind of like, okay. And they didn't even like capitalize on the intro. And I said that to them as like, we got to go like large, man, when that thing kicks in. Cause even Neil Sean is going, ticka, ticka, tick, you know, and he's doing something. And I said, I want to like metalify it. Like, let's blow it up. And it became that cool collaboration of, let's try some things. What can we get away with? Let's put the verse. Let's do some half steps. This is Metallica kind of molesting Journey in a little bit of a way. And, I'll never forget that when I went into the studio, I brought the track for them to cut to. Nobody had heard it yet, and everybody liked it. And I was like, here's the, you know, but we're going to recut all these instruments later, but here's what we're going to cut the vocal to. And I just remember saying, you guys, like, let's do it like The Voice, whether it's the battle rounds. And there's, you're just fighting for your vocal supremacy, you know? Let's just go, because you both are like Ferrari vocalists that they can do anything. Let's just make it sound like a battle round. And that's exactly what we got, because it is epic. They ain't nothing. There's no limit to what they're doing in that song. You know, it's crazy. So good on Journey for writing it, but good on the talent of Daughtry and Lizzie and everybody involved. And you know, it was a pleasure to work on it. It really, really was.
There's got to be some nerves too when you're covering a song sung by Steve Perry.
Hell yeah, dude, he's one of the greatest ever.
Yeah,
one of the greatest, man. But they're not slouches, you know. These two are
absolutely
great.
Not. Yeah. No, they're great. But I was just, you know, thinking like, you know, when you go in and you're covering that, you know, that presence has to be in that room. Like, hey, you know, we're singing a song that was sung by one of the greatest ever. We got to, you know, we got to have our shit down.
Yeah. And they, you know what though? Here's what I believe. I think that they were just more worried about impressing each other And that made for really great, healthy competition in that song, because it wasn't even competition. They have mad love for each other, but that showed, you know, and you can hear it. And, you know, they're having fun, but we worked. It wasn't like just like that. It was done. I mean, it was work. But everybody knew that we were on to something special, and yeah, it was great, man. I mean, it came together pretty fast at the end. And then when we put it out, I mean, it was everywhere in like 48 hours. It was getting a lot of attention. So it's doing well on the radio right now too. So
yeah.
I'm grateful for that.
What's next for you?
What's next for me? Well, I'm going to produce the new Dorothy record. The new Daughtry record I'm going to co-produce with Marty. I'm finishing the Aaron Jones record right now with Marty. I'm finishing the new New Year's Day album with Mitch Marlowe. He and I are co-producing that. Co-producing is a great way to be able to allow yourself to do other projects, you know, so that you're not just locked into one thing for such a long period of time. It really, there's certain things that I want to produce alone or feel like might just benefit from that, but it's good to have that co-production because I can work on five or six songs and the other guy can work on five or six songs. And that allows me to go do something else. So, finishing the New Year's Day record will be in the next like month. Aaron is just about finished. Dorothy starting, Daughtry starting. You know, I'm going to do some cool stuff with the Exes song that I just released, and a lyric video's coming for that, and a few things there as a private kind of fun distraction. Other than that, you know, we've the Four Horsemen, which is a group of guys we have our own imprint through Roundhill, and we work and collaborate together, and we have a lot of songs coming out over the next few months. We have like, I think like four or five songs on the charts right now. Zach Malloy and Blair Daly, who are part of the Four Horsemen. We all have names, by the way. Blair Daly is Death. Zach Malloy is Famine. I am Conquest, and Marty is War.
How'd you guys so decide that?
Not to make it a me thing, but I'm the one that thought of it. But I made it as a joke. We found ourselves. I went to Nashville and I was talking. My wife and I had bought a farm there, and I christened it with Zach and Blair to do the first rite in that farmhouse. And in that rite, we kind of talked about our publishing deals and that all of us were going to be free in like 3 months. And I just made a joke and said, would it be funny if we found another writer? And, you know, we're called the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. You know, we go in and just lay waste to all the other, you know, rock writers. We'll just take over, you know? And it was a joke, you know, and then as it would have it with Marty coming into the fold again, I think maybe Zach called Marty and said, I got this, you know, I was with Scott and Blair and we were talking about this thing. Let's have a meeting at your house. So we went and had a meeting at Marty's house and we sat around his pool. And I think it was like July, really hot in Nashville. And we started to talk about it and what the potential of it would be and how would we do it and, you know, why would we do it? And I think over the course of the next like month or two, we put it down on paper, you know, and vision board it kind of, and wrote down what we felt like we were worth to a publisher as a four, you know, power writing, you know, machine. And Roundhill went for it. They loved it, you know, and they nurtured it. They're nurturing us and they believe in it. And, you know, we're sought after. We're doing what we need to do. We're needed. And and we help each other. It's wonderful, man. It's the best publishing deal I've ever been a part of. And I love that it sprang from a joke into something that's real. And we even have t-shirts.
With each like conquest famine on it, or really?
Absolutely. Well, all of us have our logos. We'll have to get you one.
You mentioned again, the artists that you're going to be working with and are working with, and a lot of those names are part of this new generation of rock music. You know, whether it's A-Ron, whether it's Dorothy, Goodbye June, there's so many new bands, especially coming out of Nashville and that area. Do you ever put yourself in that like thought process of what is rock music today? Or do you just write music and connect with the artists that you're doing? Do you ever like think of the importance of some of the newer artists that you're working in, what they mean to kind of rock and roll, rock music today?
Well, I think that a lot of that comes from when you're with them and you have to listen to what they want and what they like. Some of them write more than others, but most of them have a pretty clear idea of where they want to go and who they like. Who they're influenced by and where they see their lane. And I don't think we're all too conscious of like, ooh, does it sound totally modern? Does it sound right? I think we kind of feel it. I mean, we kind of know. Like one artist that I haven't talked about yet is Lilith Czar. She's a new artist. And like, I started working with her about a year after the pandemic, and it took a while to find out what it was. But when we hatched Anarchy, and that was Blair, Zach, and I, and Lilith in a room, it just felt great. And it, you know what? I just produced it how I felt. And before I knew it, it was like, it was on octane every 45 minutes. It was on there constantly. And there was no real thought of like, we got to make it feel like it fits in with octane. It just did, for whatever reason, or this song just worked unto itself and resonated with people. And ultimately I think productions are important, but the song is more important. And you can, like you were saying before, you can have a great song with mediocre production and it will work. But if you have a okay song with great production, nobody cares. It's got to be a good song, man, at the end of the day. And if you get both of them, then you're winning, But we're not so... Anyway, for some, there are bands where like, yeah, we really want to sound modern. We want to sound kind of like this. So, I'll steer it towards there. And then hopefully you find something that is at least a one degree of separation so that they have their own individual, quality.
Is there things that you still want to accomplish as a writer and producer that you are working towards? That you haven't.
I want to win a Grammy.
You do? Okay.
I got a Christian Grammy right here. That's a Dove Award.
What do they call Christian Grammy? Or
they call it a Dove Award.
Okay. Okay. I think of that South Park episode where Cartman starts that Christian rock band in order to get a platinum album, but they don't have platinum albums. Remember that episode, Faith Plus One?
No, oh, but I love hysterical. That concept.
Hysterical.
I love that. I would love to win be a part of something that wins a Grammy. How fun would that be? But that, that's not. That's just like a. That's not really what I'm after. But it would be fun to have something like that. Because I love when you can look at a. I've got some gold and platinum records on the wall, and you can look back at those and go, "Yeah, I remember when we did that," and. It's amazing, and it's nice to have those little tokens, of accomplishment and whatnot, and kind of reminds you that, you're moving forward. You are doing things. Sometimes you need to it's good to look at what you've done, because sometimes you'll forget about it, or you miss it, it's good to have little, mementos, I guess, sometimes. But did I answer your question fully there?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, it's, I think it's, you know, important to get the recognition. Absolutely. And it's important to, I don't know if it's a sense of validation, because, you know, I don't think things give you validation. I think completion of things give you validation, right?
I agree.
Yeah. You mentioned the beginning of this interview about just working it out and getting there. You know, I think that validates you of going through that whole journey of recording an album or writing a song and finishing it and completing the vision.
And then the how is not up to you, right? Yeah, I mean, yeah. the what is what you focus on, the thing that you're working on, and then the how, that ain't up to you. So yeah, you better feel some kind of gratification with what it is that you're working on. And that is the success, you know. Me finishing that Spirits High song after not doing something for 16 years is definitely, I feel like that's a win, because I did it. It's done. Whatever happens now is not really up to me. So, you know, and that's the way it is for, I think, for anything, you know, whether I'm working with, you know, Lilith or Nothing More or Brent Smith from Shinedown or whatever it is. And it's, you know, we're all after something. We want to finish it. We want to feel it, make sure it feels good. And then we put it out there into the river, man. And then that's it. It takes it and it goes where it's going to go.
Well, Spirits High, you know, I think that what makes the song so great is capturing what a lot of people were feeling, you know. I mean, the depths of depression are so, like, when you're in depression, you don't realize it until, like, weeks later. Like, you don't have something, you don't feel blue one day and say, oh, I'm depressed. You just, exactly. Most people don't recognize it until, like, they're in deep in it. And, you know, having that song to kind of represent what many people were feeling, I think that's, you know, like I said, out of tragedy comes beauty. And, you know, a song that kind of captures what a lot of people went through and still kind of have the after effects of it, I think that's what makes it so great and why it's resonating with so many people.
Thank you so much, man. Thank you. I mean, like, I don't feel like, I mean, I guess I didn't realize that I needed to say what I needed to say. And I heard somebody say, I didn't realize that I needed to hear this song. I didn't realize that that's what I needed to hear. Because as you said, sometimes we don't realize the depth of what's happening to us. And it's not only until, it's like quicksand, right? You're just kind of sinking slowly down. All of a sudden, wait a minute, I'm up to my neck and I can't move. And, you know, I'm just, I was not conscious at all for the probably first time in my life of writing to try to make this relate to everybody else. I did this solely for me to try to be able to just cope. And it really helped. It really helped me to kind of, like, push through and realize that, you know, this is where I am and this is what I got to deal with. And I got to keep putting one foot in front of the other. And I made it through it. And, you know, I hope it helps other people too, because it helped me. And I think the truth is in there on that thing. So.
Well, that freedom, you mentioned it, like, you're writing the song for you. It's much harder to have a song like that if you're being pushed by a record label or another artist. You're writing that song. This is your song. This is what you're feeling. And no one's getting in the way of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that you picked up on that, because I think I said that to my wife. I was like, nobody's telling me what to do. it's pretty, this is liberating. This is crazy, because guess what? It isn't going anywhere. It doesn't matter, you know? And yeah. And now here it is, you know? So somehow that 20th anniversary, I made up my mind to let the diary page be shown. I'm glad I did. You know, that, sometimes I think there's things that we have to keep to ourselves. And then I think there's those rarities when there are those private moments that you want to share. And that seemed okay to share, because I guess I feel like I, I healed from it, right? You know, and I'm past it now. I'm not fully, probably ever, but at the same time, enough has changed to where it felt okay to share it and to be okay with that, and not be so frightened by it, you know, to embrace it a little bit more.
Scott, it's been a great conversation, man. I really enjoyed the time with you and getting to know you.
Jay, likewise, man. I mean, this is amazing, dude. I mean, my first podcast ever is with you, and your questions are great. And, you know, you really understand what you're doing, and thanks for making me feel comfortable. And I love that we have Tyler and Goodbye June in common because they're salt of the earth. I love those guys. And, I'm hopefully going to see Tyler next week because I go to Nashville. So
nice. I interviewed Ace Von Johnson one time. Great, great dude. And he's like, dude, talking with you is like being on TED Talk.
Nice.
I'm like, I guess that's a compliment. So
very relaxing, man. It's I love it. So let me ask you this for my innocence here. Is this only audio, or are we doing video too? Or is it just
audio only?
Oh, audio only. Okay.
Yeah. I haven't promoted myself to do video as well. You know, I've got a real life job, and I don't have enough hours in a day. I've got a high school senior that, you know, is a single dad. So it's like, I'd love to do video, but it's just not the cards at this time.
Not the cards at this time. Well, you're doing just fine, man. I'm very honored to be on here, and thank you so much for doing the research and helping, you know, or giving me a platform to talk a little bit about my story. This is the very first time this has ever happened. So thank you so much.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. I look forward to doing it again.
Yeah, man.
You know, talk about some of those albums that you worked on, and, you know, we're running, you know, I'd love to get into that with you. So, you know, sooner or later we'll do that.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I got some good stories from the time I was a runner, like mind blowing records that I got to see behind the curtain a little bit on, you know.
Definitely so cool. Do that, man. I can't wait.
All right, Jay. Well, thank you so much. Have a wonderful evening.
Thanks again, Scott. For all of you listening, check out the Exes, Spirits High. You can stream it everywhere. It's on Spotify and all streaming services. So check it out. It's a great tune. One that I believe a lot of my audience can relate to. I'm Jay Scott. This is another episode of the Hook Rocks, the Ultimate Rock TV Podcast. Take care of each other. Stay safe. We'll talk soon. Thanks.
Blood on my hands, what's done is done. Left it by the road with the crows and the dust. Heart so hollow, deep as a cave. One day I'll be dancing on your grave. Taking it back, the life you stole. Every little piece you took of my soul. Now I lay you down to sleep and I pray with the devil you rest in peace. You can't hang
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.